might as well get started. We kind of felt a little rush last time, so let's get a jump on. I'm John Weisenberger. I live in Owatonna, Minnesota, and I pastor a church, and I also teach at a community college. I teach world religions and philosophy, specifically the philosophy of social justice. So, the things I do, and if you want to know more, I teach in a jail setting with outside and inside students, and it's actually my favorite thing to do in the world, so I'm not going to talk about it here. We're going to talk about Buddhism. So, how many people have some experience or with Buddhism? Or, okay, not too many. So, we'll start from the basics, and if anyone has a question, don't be afraid to jump in. Just ask it or raise your hand, and we'll just make our way through. I think probably you could argue the most important three people in the history of the world would be Jesus, Muhammad, and Buddha, if you look at the influence that they've had over the world. So it does us well as citizens of the planet to know who the Buddha is, and at least to know his story. So I'm glad you're here. Let's see. How to start. People know the story of the Buddha? There's a lot of stories about the Buddha, so sometimes you'll hear it one way, and then you might hear it another way. It's the same thing with Abraham. If you look at, there's a lot of Islamic texts about Abraham. There's a lot of Jewish texts about Abraham. Crazy stories. And so, the Abraham you know in the Bible, there's like a lot more about Abraham. And that's true about the Buddha, too. There's a lot more about the Buddha. And people get it in different ways, so I'll try to kind of cover it in a big way, and if you heard it differently, let me know. Okay. Do we have handouts for everybody? Everybody have?
We're a bit short over here.
Okay.
Siri's still going.
Oh, she's still going. Okay. We'll get them. So the story of the Buddha, I could let Joseph Campbell tell it because I got him, but he takes a lot longer than me, so I'll tell the story quickly. A lot of stories about his origins, a lot of them similar to what we know in terms of the birth narrative of Jesus. There is kind of an annunciation for Buddha's mother. There's a god that comes to her in the form of a white elephant, and he impregnates her. Again, there's a lot of these different stories. He is born miraculously out of her side, not, you know, kind of representing the heart level and not lower levels of energy. He's, because they're Hindus. He's born in a place near Nepal today, and his father is a Shakya, the Shakya people king. So he rules over this. Yeah. Who needs him? What side do we need him on? Okay. So here's just some terms and some basic kind of things we're going to cover today on both sides. So, anyway, there's. She has the Buddha, and then she dies in a week. And he's raised by his aunt and his father. Wise men come to visit and to see this child that they've heard about. And so they have a prophecy about the Buddha. And actually, it's not named the Buddha now. His name is Siddhartha Gautama. Okay. So Siddhartha Gautama, his father is a great king. And so his father's expecting Siddhartha to become, to follow in his stead. The wise men come and they tell his father that he will either be a world ruler or a world teacher. So his father, of course, being king, wants him to be a world ruler, to be an emperor. And so he goes and he does everything in his power to keep Siddhartha from seeing anything that will cause him to want to be a world teacher. So he basically contains Siddhartha within the courts and the castle. And so Siddhartha can't leave. He gets married, he has children, and he's never left his sort of father's courtyards. And he's a young man, and one day it occurs to him, he's never been outside, you know. And he knows there's a town there. He hears that there's a town near his father's castle, or his castle. He's a prince. And so he kind of sneaks out. He knows his dad's going to be mad. So he sneaks out with some servants, and he goes into town. And as he goes into town, he sees what's called the four passing sights. And the first thing he sees is someone who's old by the side of the road, can barely walk. he's never seen someone that old. And he asks his servants, what's that? And they said, it's an old man. Well, what's that? Old age. And he says, oh, I never realized the age. Next thing he sees is a sick person by the side of the road. What's that? Sick man. That's the second passing sight. Oh, didn't realize that anyone got sick. I've never seen it. Third one's a dead man by the side of the road. So he's contemplating age, sickness, and death. And then the fourth thing he sees is one of those, and in India they're all over the place, little hairy naked guys. They're called sannyasin. They're the forest dwellers. They're the wise men of India, the wild wise men. And he sees one on the road, and he goes up to him. He asks the servants, who is that? Well, that's the wise man. So the fourth passing said, he sits at the feet of the wise man for that day, and then he's determined that he's going to leave. He's going to become a renunciate and leave everything behind. So he goes to the castle. He tells his wife and kids, I got to go. He tells his dad, I'm done. And he leaves everything behind, and he walks out. So the Buddha starts to walk around and talk to these wise men. He wants wisdom. He meets five friends, and he journeys together, and they go into a life of severe asceticism, and then fasting, and they renounce everything. I can't grab the picture from the video, but anyone ever see the picture of the Buddha, the emaciated Buddha? Pretty famous, and it's just ribs are just, you know, it's called anorexic Buddha, I don't know, whatever you want to call it. But he gets so thin that he almost dies. And he's overcome, and he passes out as he's meditating. And a woman comes along and sees him and kind of revives him a little bit and gives him food to eat. And when he eats the food, he realizes he's been restored, and he says, this extreme asceticism is not the way. And so that's the first teaching of the Buddha way, is the middle path of moderation. So you'll hear that in Buddhist teaching. So out of his story comes that first teaching, that the middle way is the better way, not the extremes. So Buddhism is known for that. And the other quote that comes from that, and he quotes this to his disciples again and again, when seeking enlightenment, be gentle with yourself. Okay, so it's a nice quote to remember, be gentle with yourself. So there's that sense in Buddhism of you know, don't try the extremes. So Buddha decides that he is going to find enlightenment by himself. And so it kind of, you know, I think that's a Native American thing, draw the circle on the ground and don't leave there until you have the vision. Well, Buddha sits himself down, and traditionally it's under the Bodhi tree. Sometimes it gets translated banyan tree, because a banyan is a real tree. But the Bodhi tree, Bodhi means enlightenment. So kind of a symbolic tree. He sits down under the tree and meditates until it's revealed to him. And so the first thing that happens in these stories is either Mara, who's kind of this god of chaos or evil, or Kama, K-A-M-A, is the lord of the world. So one of these two, usually in the story, they come and they see the Buddha attempting to reach enlightenment. And they want to prevent this. And so Mara or Kama come, and the first temptation, there's three temptations, sound familiar, of the Buddha. And the Buddha, just, if you remember from last time, the Axis Age, we covered that for those of you who were here last time, the Axis Age, everything changes in the world in 500 BCE, BC or BCE for those that are studying all the religions of the world. So that's when the Buddha is born. Right in the Axis Age. So where was that? He's sitting under the Bodhi tree. He's meditating. And either Mara or Kama come with the first temptation, which is pleasure. So these dancing women come, beautiful, and they try to tempt Buddha out of his meditation. And I'll show you this, but one of the statues of the Buddha, he has his middle finger on the ground. He's in a lotus position, and he touches the ground. That's a symbol that he's grounded, and he's not moved by that first temptation. So Kama or Mara comes with fear, everything, an army of fear. So demons and everything that he can possibly, you know, be afraid of come and attack him. And again, he touches the ground, he's grounded, and they disappear. Or they turn into lotuses or whatever story you're listening to. This is the second temptation. The third temptation is the most interesting one to me. It's duty. Duty. And so the tempter comes and says, think of all the things you're leaving behind, your family, your duty to your people and your father to be king. You cannot do this. All these people are counting on you, Siddhartha. And that's the third temptation. Isn't that fascinating? When we think about that as good Christians, you know, Protestants, work ethic and all that. And Buddha, again, touches the ground and is not moved by that temptation. And after that, he achieves enlightenment. And there's stories about the entire universe. The elephant that Kama, the Lord of the Worlds, on bows down and worships him, and all kinds of stuff happens. But in the most stripped-down story, Buddha basically sees how it all works, and he opens his eyes, and the first thing he says is, this cannot be taught. This cannot be taught. And he becomes the Buddha once he's enlightened. Anyone know what the word Buddha means? Wake up! And Buddha woke up from the dream because everything is an illusion. We'll get to this too. But for those of you that were present with the Hinduism class, what is this? Remember that? The cosmic cycle? Cosmic cycle. If you're a good Hindu, and Siddhartha was a good Hindu, you start as, we went all the way back to the quark or the atom, on the atomic level, a little piece of God, and you work your way up through the mineral cycle, life and death, all these cycles of reincarnation. You work your way through the mineral kingdom and the plant kingdom, billions of lifetimes, there's a plant, then the animal kingdom, and then you finally make your way through evolution, the evolution of the consciousness and the soul. You make your way into the human, and you live how many lives? 800 lives. The plant life is like 8,000, or animals 8,000, plants 80,000, minerals 800,000. 800 human lifespans. The caste system is decided by this. And then you go into 80 life cycles of what would be kind of angelic. And then you enter the Godhead for 8 life cycles, and then you're free. So that's a basic Hindu idea about the cosmic cycle. Karma governs this. This whole thing is called samsara. And that's the Hindu version of how everything works. Now, Buddha sees this, he understands it all, and what he says finally. Let me go back to his narrative story. He wakes up and he stands up and he starts to journey out, and the first thing he meets is his 5 friends. Did I tell you about his 5 friends? So he had, I can't remember if I told that part, did I? His 5 friends were journeying with him, and they were the extreme fasters, the ascetics. And when he renounced the asceticism, they rejected him. They said, no, this is the way. And so he comes across them again, and when they meet him, he begins to talk to them, and they realize something's changed. This one has achieved enlightenment. And so they become his first disciples. And it's interesting because what they want to know, when they see that the Buddha understands completely, what they want to know, they said, how does this work? What's it all about? Show us, tell us, teach us. And he says nothing. It's called the silence of the Buddha. And they're very frustrated because he won't talk to them. And what he says is, you don't need to know. The only thing you need to know is what is most necessary, and that's how to relieve suffering. Because he says, life is suffering. And the thing about Buddhism is, this was release called moksha in Hinduism at the very end of the cosmic cycle. And Buddha comes along and says, you can leave anytime you want. Especially you humans who become self-conscious. So, because this whole thing, Buddhists believe in this. They believe it's true. They believe this is the way it all works. And yet, it is all an illusion. So in Hinduism, you know, this, it's not real. It's real in one sense, but it's not the ultimate reality. And what the Buddha says is that all of this is a product of the mind, that the mind has created this. And that's the problem, that we're all trapped in this state of mind that keeps us in suffering, that his, you know, another quote by the Buddha, life is suffering. Change is suffering. Life is change. If you look at the back of that, it says Central Buddhist Teachings, it says Four Passing Sights and the Three Jewels. The three marks of reality for the Buddha is that life is change. And the word dukkha, you can see that with the Four Noble Truths. Dukkha is a word that means suffering, but it can mean you know, the worst suffering possible, chronic pain, torture, all that kind of suffering. But it also means the kind of suffering that I see happening right now in this room, which is that you're never still. You never stop moving. You never stop changing. As a human being in this life, you have to move. Right? I mean, just try sitting here for an hour and not moving. What happens? Yeah, something is always moving you on to something else. Something is always changing about your reality, and that is the cause of suffering. Whether it's the smallest little piece or the biggest. But that's the nature of this reality, governed by samsara. So the Buddha wants to show his followers the way out. And where's my... This is what happened to me last time with the eraser. Oh, there. And when his first disciples ask him, you know, show us, tell us what, he says, no. He says, what you're asking is like this. When a man gets shot by an arrow, he doesn't need to know how deep it's gone or what bacteria, I don't know if he said bacteria, but, you know, basically how it's going to be infected or what the loss of blood is that's happening or any of those details. What he needs is the arrow removed. And he said, I am here to teach you how to remove the arrow of suffering from your life. And so that's his, probably the core teaching of Buddhism, is to end suffering. You see the Four Noble Truths there? Life is suffering. It's caused by our attachments to either desire or to self. So the whole cause of suffering for human beings is the fact that they think that they are themselves. That you say the word I and you mean it. That you think of yourself as an I. I did this and I do this and I am this. And that's the problem. And so, and the third noble truth, if you end this desire, if you end this attachment to life and to yourself, then you end suffering. And the way to do that, the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path. And you can see the Eightfold Path there. Very simple. It starts on an internal level. You realize what it means to understand this, right understanding, right intention. You have an intention to move out of your suffering. Then you have these externals, right speech, right action, right work, right effort. And then it moves you, as you go down the path, back into the internal. You become mindful. You have meditation. And then through the right meditation, right consciousness, or concentration, you achieve what's called what we would call consciousness. There's sort of mind, which is a negative thing, and then there's consciousness, which is the reality behind that. And that's what the Buddha does, moves into that, and that is nirvana. Okay. So how is this going? Too fast, or any questions?
It sounds like you have to do a lot of things right.
What's that?
It sounds like you have to do a lot of things right.
Do a lot. This is more practical practice, I think. Actually, I had a really good friend in college who said, he ended up becoming a Buddhist, and you know, he was raised, I don't know if his dad was a pastor or whatever, he said, Buddhism gives me something to do. You know, he felt like his Christian faith didn't give him any spiritual practice that he could do. And so he turned to Buddhism that gave him a spiritual practice in meditation. So it's interesting. I don't think it would be a law in the way that it sounded like you're
doing it just right.
Right.
And then you'll get
it. No, things are more moderate, I think, in Buddhism. There's not that it comes along that middle path of moderation. Good question.
What do Buddhists have to say about consumerism, the consumer culture?
Yeah, I mean, they're usually against it, you know. It's part of the whole, you know, when mind takes over, things start to get crazy. And attachment and all these things, and that's Western culture. Right? I mean, capitalism is an extreme form of attachment to things, to money. So I think the hardest thing for Westerners to really understand about Buddhism, and this is really the core of Buddhism, is called Anatman. So we who studied Hinduism, where was our starting point?
Atman.
Atman, right? So you see the an mean is a negative. So Atman in Hinduism is the soul of Brahman. It's the soul of the world. It's the soul of the universe. In Hinduism, we are all pieces of Atman, that whole New Age idea of, you know, you're the spark of God or the drop of God or whatever that is. That comes right out of Hinduism. Atman individuates itself into you and me. And then we live through our life cycles and we're restored back to Atman. So Buddhism is Anatman, no Atman. That's the true reality. Yes, they believe in Atman, but they don't believe Atman's really real. Okay. Likewise, this gets translated as no self, no God. Big G, little g, whatever G you want to use. It doesn't really exist. These are constructions and aggregates of the energy of the cycle of samsara. It all works on one level, but at the most basic level, it is an illusion. Buddhism looks at this world and says, it is an illusion. It's one that has trapped us into thinking it's real, and we suffer, and we don't know how to get out of it. That's core Buddhism. So, let's start with the no self. How do they explain no self? When I read a little bit older Buddhist texts, they talk a lot about, what's the word? I wrote it down because I can never remember it. Oh yeah, aggregate. They talk about a human being as an aggregate, and that aggregate thinks of itself as a thing. I prefer to use the analogy of a car. How many people have names for their cars? Okay? What are a few of the names, just for fun, right?
Hiram Silver.
That's the name of your car? Awesome. Anyone else?
Got Bessie.
Bessie. Okay. So why did you name your car Bessie?
It was like an old lady.
Okay.
It was.
When I grew up, my best friend Steve, when I was in high school, his grandmother gave him a Delta 88, 1968. Had like a 405 horsepower engine in it. The trunk was bigger than my car is today. We used to go to the Boundary Waters and put 5 people and all our luggage in this thing. It could go 140 miles an hour with a canoe on top of it. And the name of that car was Duke. And we still talk about Duke today. I mean, honestly, it was the best car ever. And the best thing about it is you could take the key out of it when it was running, so I'd give it to my friend all the time. I'd pull the key, and then I'd go walk up to my house, and then he'd call me from home saying, "You took my key." And all these stories about Duke and our experience with Duke, that car is a good friend of mine. I have a relationship with that car. And so what is that car? And so that's the point of an Atman. If you feel where I'm going now? So think about your car if you have a name for it, and what happens if you pop the tire? What do you do?
You
Change it, right? Well, what happens if the rotors go out? And the head gasket, and so it pops a rod. Maybe the upholstery goes bad. Paint's bad. What do you do? Let's say you love this car, like no other. Right? This is the car you want. This is, dude. And so you know you have. At one point you shear the top off of it, and you weld back on the steel, and the chassis rusts out, and you replace the chassis of the car because you love that car. In fact, you go along and you replace every single part of that car. Every single part. So, is it still Duke? And how does it bear resemblance to the car that it was in 1968? How is that the same car?
Your relationship.
Hmm? Our relationship. My concept of it. Right? My giving it an identity. For the Buddha, you are that car for yourself. That's what you are. And you love that car like no other car. And you have a lot of experiences with that car. And you have put your heart and soul into that car for as long as you can remember. But everything gets replaced on. In fact, that even physics says that. Except for a few molecules, I think, in our stomachs, every atom in our body gets replaced every 7 years. So the actual physical substance of ourselves is not the same. So what are we? That's the question. That's the Buddhist question. What are we? Who are we? And he says this attachment to this, not realizing it's an illusion, is the core of suffering. And if we can let go of the attachment, then you let go of suffering and you reach nirvana. So that's kind of the core. Any questions about that? Is that weird?
You're letting go of your own suffering or the suffering of other people?
All.
All.
Yeah.
That sounds selfish.
There you go. Perfect. That's perfect. That's the. Isn't that interesting? The doctrine is of no self, and what's your response to it? That's the perfect Western response, isn't it? And that's why Westerners, what is the Western ideal, especially in America? Me, myself, and I, as what? A rugged individualist, right? John Wayne on his horse. If any trouble comes, he just takes care of it. That's our identity, isn't it? As a people. And so there, how can Westerners even approach this? And I love that you said that because it's perfect. That sounds selfish. It's the perfect paradox to a doctrine saying, no, it's about no self. Well, that's selfish. Okay. Yeah, John.
I heard, and I don't know, but this stuff, my dad was telling me once that, because he studied this a little bit in college, that there's a certain like school or branch of Buddhism where
we'll jump
the
into
idea
that.
Is that you're coming, you seek nirvana, but then the point is to come back and help other people.
Okay, since you brought it up, let's just look right here. Look at the terms, and I'll show you exactly the difference there. About a third of the way down, see that Theravada? Sometimes called Theravada or Theravada. That is the most conservative branch of Buddhism. It's the original school. And the whole goal is to have practice detachment and reach nirvana. And that's it. Okay. So that's practiced in Southeast Asia quite a bit, Theravada Buddhism. The other Buddhist schools, especially in China and Tibet, are different. Tibet is its own thing. But you see the word Mahayana, called the big vehicle? That's the majority of Buddhists today. And their goal, the goal of Theravada is nirvana, or detachment. You become an arhat, it's called, when you're completely detached from all things, when you're selfish, right? Because you're so non-self, you don't care about anybody else. That's Theravada's goal. Mahayana's goal is compassion. So the word is not, they don't use the word Buddha as much as Bodhisattva, if you know that word. So those who have achieved enlightenment in Mahayana Buddhism, those who are able to enter nirvana, what happens in Mahayana Buddhism, you achieve enlightenment and you see the door to nirvana and you step into it, So you're part out of the illusion, part way, and then you are called back into the world as a bodhisattva. You take the bodhisattva vow, which is pretty cool. The bodhisattva vow is, I will not fully enter nirvana until the very last person in the world enters in before me. So that's the goal of the bodhisattva. Whether it's there are physical bodhisattvas on earth, there are sort of this angelic, non-bodily bodhisattvas as well, and they help the world to achieve enlightenment. So that's maybe an answer to your question.
Does that then imply that like ideally no one really ever gets to nirvana? Because if you say like until every other person before me,
you would disappear. Full enlightenment means you no longer you basically leave. You're in complete control of the whole illusion, so you could appear or disappear at will, and you stay. Because this whole thing, the reason that the doctrine of no self, the whole thing is an illusion. Is it Sharon? See, the problem is, Sharon, you don't understand this part, that it's all an illusion. You're convinced it's still real, that there's still people suffering, and you're suffering, and you're not going to buy it, right? And what the Buddha says is it's like a dream. So everybody here has dreamt before. Everybody had a nightmare? What happens in your nightmare?
Scared,
shake, you sweat, fear, adrenaline. How many people have ever woken up with their adrenaline going? Sweating.
Yep.
You done that? So, was that real? That dream, that nightmare?
No.
It wasn't real? And why are you sweating? And that's the point. That's what this is to a Buddhist. Everything that we're doing is a dream. And so you ask yourself, in my dream, can I control my dream when I'm dreaming? Can I get out of my dream? Have you had the experience where you're in a dream you don't want to be in and you get out? You don't have that kind of control? It's the same thing for here. This is a dream too. And so whether you're asleep and dreaming or whether you're awake and dreaming, it's the same thing. And so the idea of enlightenment is you come to an awareness of that, yeah.
Okay, one of the things that's problematic from a Western standpoint is that we become attached to the detachment, and then we get hung up on things like goals and defining and definition.
Right.
And so for you to even explain what the Buddha was describing is going to fall short.
Yeah. It's often called no mind as well. That's the goal of meditation. And I make my classes do this, but we don't really have time. Go and sit still and don't think. That's a classic Buddhist meditation. Just try it. You know, just sit there. What happens? For five minutes, can you not think? Give it a try. See what happens. As soon as you try to do it, it's just like... You know, it's just like thoughts and ideas out of everywhere, and you try to still them, you know, be quiet. And you might force the will kind of keep them down for a while, and then you try and sit in that silence, and what happens again? Your mind is unruly. Another Buddhist quote is, let me paraphrase a little bit. Let's say you had a jar. It talks about in terms of a muddy river or a muddy pond, but if you put dirt in a jar of water and you shake it up, you can't see through it. He says that's what we are as people. We're doing this all the time. There's no time when we're not still, when we're not in meditation, when our mind is quiet, so we cannot see through at all. That's why we do not achieve enlightenment. If you set it down and you let it sit, it'll settle. That's what meditation is. So Buddhist meditation is about letting the mind settle. If you can quiet your mind, then you will be able to see through the illusion. Okay? Yeah?
So does So Buddhism had a God? I mean, nowhere in what you describe, it sounds like it's all a self thing.
It's about people that sometimes nirvana gets described as nothing, which is really hard for Westerners to see. Other places it gets described as bliss, and other places it gets described as pure consciousness. So entering your own consciousness, entering fully into, whether it's totally empty or totally full, or whatever this full consciousness is, that is the goal. That's the only thing that really is. And if you call it a God, or you call it a thing, you define it, then you really don't, you're not there yet. How's that?
So he does not believe that there was a Buddhism doesn't address the fact of whether there was a creation, or whether there was a supreme being. It's
actually,
like it's all a state of mind.
Well, they understand this Hindu idea of creation, that there are these powers that are creating. But what the Buddha is saying is that beyond that, when you really see what it is, it's like a movie on a screen. Is the movie real? When you're watching a movie, what is it? It's light passing through colored slot picture. And you watch, when you go to a movie, what happens at a movie? Really, really good movie. See, now we gotta keep coming around here to get this core idea. One of the best movies that you've ever watched, and what happens? Big drama, you know, there's something happens and there's a climactic fear point and they overcome it and they fall in love and on, and it's just tears and you go through it and you're crying, right? And what was that? That was just light, colored pictures and some sound. Was it real? This is the point of Buddhism. And so the creation that you're talking about, all this, all these mountains out here, and all these people in this room, and everything else that is, and we know it's real, we know it had a creator. And what Buddhism would say, let's take a modern Buddhist understanding to the point of quantum physics. What is reality right now? You have a electromagnetic energy is the foundation of the whole thing, right? The universe. And it has a positive field and a negative field. So the wave, when it comes into being, it's real, and when it goes out into the void, it's not real. And it's going back and forth, right? Like that. So when it's in the positive, it exists, and when it's in the negative, it doesn't exist. And a modern Buddhist would say, that's happening right now. Reality is flickering into reality and out at very fast speed. And your mind is the only thing convincing you that it's constant. But it's not. Even physics can show you that it's not real. It doesn't really exist. How's that? This is the core reality of quantum physics that they're studying right now. Nothing is real. There's nothing here.
Then how can it be a reality?
It's your reality because you believe in it,
you
right?
You said it was a core reality. Then you can't
right.
just contradict it.
At the end, it's this.
Are there Buddhist physicists?
Is not nirvana real?
Right, that's the point. Yes, no, I don't know. I mean, the right answer is yes, because the Buddha gets to a point where he understands it and is one with it, and, you know, there's all these descriptors of bliss, complete understanding, oneness. You know, in the end, I don't know. And Buddhism's really comfortable with that. Christianity is not.
When we were in Korea, we were in many, many Buddhist temples. What is the purpose of their temples? And we were on this incredible mountain inside this cave that had this huge Buddha made out of stone.
Yeah.
Kind of like we would have our Mount Rushmore.
Yeah. Well, the craziest thing about studying the religions of the world is we can study the core aspects of Hinduism and Buddhism, and when you go to those countries, nobody talks about it like that. Remember? Like when you go to India, what's 95% of the practices sacrifice to a god? not all this other crazy stuff. When you go to Buddhist temples, you have, especially in China and other places in Southeast Asia and even India, you have the same kind of practice. People call themselves Buddhists and they go to the temple and sacrifice to the Buddha. And so there's all these, whether you go to a Taoist temple or a Buddhist temple or a Confucian temple, they all kind of look alike because there's statues of these gods and you offer sacrifice and there's, you know, all this stuff going on. And is that Buddhism? Well, yeah, but it's not the kind that you get deep into like this. Does that answer your question? I don't know.
I'm wondering what they do there. And then there were all these monks, these Buddhist monks, and we were explained, it was told that we couldn't tell the men from the women, all their heads are shaved.
Right.
And we were told that women who would give their children up for adoption for a real good reason would go there because they had no other place else to go.
Right.
They weren't marriageable.
I mean, the core place where Buddhism is practiced is in meditation. You know, if you go to a temple, it's kind of like, is that really Buddhism? Well, you have to say yes. Right? I mean, how is Christianity practiced? Is it practiced by going to the seminary and understanding the doctrine, or is it practiced by going to worship? You know, I mean, but when religious scholars talk about Buddhism, they say it's these core ideas. The practice is really meditation, no-mindedness. That's the goal.
And so all these thousands and thousands of tablets that they have, what are they?
Well, okay, let's... good questions. That's in the next place we're going in 15 minutes. Any questions about this again? Do we need to circle around one more time? Yeah. They bear a lot of resemblance to one. I mean, in China especially, they're always in dialogue. You know, Zen Buddhism is really what I would say is Taoism. I mean, they just are right up against one another. Yeah, when you think of Taoism, you think of Zen Buddhism. That really practicing no mind and flow and energy. I don't want to say anything. Did I hit the anatman enough? You just have to hit it again and again and again and again and again, and then everyone goes out there and goes, that's crazy.
I apologize, I wasn't able to go to the Hindu one, and maybe the answer's there, but is Buddhism a response or a reaction to aspects of Hinduism?
Siddhartha is a Hindu.
Right.
Yeah.
But is there, like the Reformation in response to
Absolutely.
Catholicism?
Absolutely.
Is this a response to
no.
or political cultural stuff going on and all that?
Yes to all that. Especially okay. A friend of mine teaches at Augsburg College and she gave a test and the student gave an answer about Buddhism started basically before Buddha was born. And of course, you know, that's the wrong answer. But when you look at the Upanishads in Hinduism, that's where Buddhism is growing out of. So out of Hinduism, even before Buddha is born in the story, you can see Buddhism developing. Okay? And so Buddhism is really a reaction against Hinduism in a lot of ways. It rejects the caste system. You know, it rejects that whole reincarnation cycle. Buddha says it's no point to this evolution of the soul. It's an illusion too. Yeah, good question. Carol, what did you ask that I was gonna?
What the tablets?
What tablet? Sorry.
Oh well, in South Korea they have thousands and thousands of tablets that are held that are teachings of Buddha.
A lot of writings, yeah. A lot of Buddhist writings. Tripitaka is the most known. If there was a canon for some Buddhists, it would be called the Tripitaka, which are the kind of conglomerations of Buddhist teachings, but they go on and on and on, too. Lots of writings, lots of teachings. Depends on who you're talking about. Theravada has its own writings, Mahayana schools, like Pure Land, Jodo, Zen, Tendai, they all have their own schools and their own teachers and their own writings. Buddhism is huge, especially in China. And then Vajrayana, if you look at this term sheet, you have the three major schools in Buddhism. I talked about Theravada, very traditional. Mahayana is the biggest, and Mahayana means the big vehicle, and it is the biggest, and it means... I don't have time to just explain it all. You might have heard of Hinayana. Theravada gets called Hinayana. That's sort of a negative term. It means little vehicle or little school, so you don't use that. You don't use that term. But the Vajrayana Buddhism, you see that on the third, it's called the power school, power vehicle, diamond vehicle, the sometimes called the lightning vehicle. That is what the Dalai Lama and the Tibetans practice. And I'll try to get back to your question, Carol, through this. Tibetan Buddhism is very different. And Tibetan Buddhism uses meditation and instead of, if Theravada's focus was detachment and Mahayana's focus is compassion, their Vajrayana's practice, Dalai Lama, is power. How to become enlightened and understand how things work and use that in the world powerfully. So the Tibetan Buddhists have lots of stories about crazy things that look and feel just like magic. I mean, they can leap up mountainsides, and the Taoists get this too, but they can heal people, they can pass in and out of life very easily. They have chants, and they do mandalas that are really powerful, that can have an effect on the world. And so it's a Buddhism that kind of begins to use it to have power in the world, which is ironic because up against China, they have no power. But
they got the Dalai Lama out of there.
Yeah, they did. And yeah, how old is the guy? I mean, you ever meet, everyone see the Dalai Lama? I have a video of him actually. Really powerful man, positive energy. I think what I wanted to do with the Vajrayana Buddhism is they collect a lot of books and, like, talk about tablets and almost magic-like things that will show you how to control the weather, control the body, control healing, that kind of stuff. So that flows out of Buddhism too. Does that answer your question?
It tells me more than I knew.
Yeah. You always ask me a question I can't really answer. That happened last time too. That's good. Okay. Kind of all over the place trying to get this all done in an hour. Any terms there that we didn't cover? Buddha, Bodhisattva. Dharma basically means the teaching of the Buddha. Sangha is a community. So the three jewels in Buddhism are called the Buddha himself. The Dharma is his teaching, and the community. So community and the monks are very important in Buddhism. The three schools, you can see those, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana. Ahimsa comes out of Hinduism, that means do no harm, and Buddhists practice that too, try to do no harm to one another, even down to bugs, you know, don't kill them. And then you can see those words, nirvana is a primary word for enlightenment. Samadhi is also a Hindu term, it means kind of means bliss. Satori is in Zen Buddhism. Moksha is the Hinduism word. Anatman, and yeah. What if I stop talking? Any other questions? I want to show a video.
So I've been to Buddhist temples before, and I've seen people bring in their fruit or coins or whatever, and they stand and go like this. It's an average person, probably. Do they understand all that? Do they go to classes? Do they raise their children? Do they have schools?
I think it would probably be relatable to Christians in America. You know, ask the same question of them. Do they, kids in confirmation, understand anything? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, your grandmother who was born, baptized, confirmed, married, and buried in that church, and all she cared about was, you know, I mean, the church as a tradition, did she understand it, what Christianity was? You know what I mean? It's just such a big question in terms of, What does anyone understand? Where do they get their truth?
But Buddhists don't consider Buddhism a religion. That's a sociological term that Westerners put on.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, I find Buddhists that accept that and some that, like you say, don't really accept it. You know, there are Christians that are non-denominational because, why? Because there's no such thing as denominations and they have, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The true Christian church and,
well, even with their terminology, I mean, they wouldn't say they were worshiping, they were practicing. I mean, you don't know that.
Right. But Buddhists do worship at temples. There are Buddhist temples, too. I think it's kind of a sense of you'll never get rid of ritual practice that way and move into this, you know, core understanding. So you have to provide that for those that cannot jump to that understanding. Do we do that in the West? Do we do that in the Christian church? Yeah, I don't know. Okay, so let's. People have heard of Joseph Campbell.
Yes.
Died not too long ago. He's really the, you know, he knows, he's probably the most knowledgeable about all these world religions and the way myths work and so on. Let him talk to you for a little bit. Mm-hmm. Someone, if we turn on the video and turn close down. Just push it.
On the very top.
Far left.
Top left hand,
little.
Top left button.
That's it. Yeah, if we need the lights too. So if you really want to learn Buddhism, you know, you should just rent a video and watch him. He's really good.
Other one.
You know, I practice this twice, so I don't do this. Can't win. Got too much.
I'm here in New York, and I must tell you as much as I love.
Okay, we don't need her. No, where are we?
Just from Joseph.
Okay.
I understand the story. How come the Eastern tradition is so rapid?
This happens to me every time. I think I know where I am. Okay, here we go. Okay, we'll just jump to. Well, why there's Joseph Campbell. One little piece that's interesting comparatively with Christianity, let's see if I can grab it here. Let's try this.
We have the Buddha on a lotus. The lotus, like the water of the Ganges, is a manifestation of the grace of the eternal life pouring into the world. That's what the rose represents in medieval symbolism in the Christian tradition. The image of the Trinity appears on the celestial rose. The image of the Buddha appears on the celestial lotus. When you have a figure seated on the lotus, or on the rose, It is a personification of the energy already represented in that rose. So the Buddha didn't have to work at all to realize his identity. Now, there are two ways of thinking about Jesus. One, he is true man. The other, he is true God. If he was true man, he suffered. If he was true God, he didn't. Two ways of thinking about the Buddha. He is the one who sat down and meditated and found his Buddha consciousness. Two, he is also the incarnation of Buddha consciousness and didn't have to meditate at all. He knew it. And in the life legend of the Buddha, the virgin birth, the nature of the spiritual life, he had experienced the virgin birth himself. So he's born from the mother's side at the level of the heart, not the level of the pelvic natural birth. And no sooner was he born, but the deities came down and seated on a golden floor.
I'll let him tell the story of the temptation. He tells it well.
Is this part of the series?
Yeah, this is his Mythos series. No. I always think it's going to be smoother than this for some reason.
Now, this is from Tibet. The Buddha as manifestation. This wonderful posture, this is known as earth touching, Bhumi Sparsha. Now, when this quester, this seeker, this Buddha, one who was about to be the Buddha, came to the tree in the middle of the universe, the Axis Mundi, which is called the immovable spot, he sat there. That's a psychological condition. You don't have to go to Bodhgaya to find the immovable spot. You've got it right here, if you have it. And what it is the spot that is not moved by desire and fear.
One thing I really didn't mention, and he says it, that's a psychological position. And I think what I didn't connect, I wanted to more, is that Buddhism and psychology have a real strong bond, and looking at how the mind works. So that's an important thing, especially in modern Buddhism.
So, to test him, there came the Lord of the world, and his name was Desire and Fear. As desire, he was called Kama, K-A-M-A, long A, first one. That means lust, desire, delight, pleasure. And he tried to move the Buddha by displaying to him his three beautiful daughters, posturizing to beautiful towns. And their names were Desire, Fulfillment, and Regrets, future, present, and past. Now, he had disengaged himself from the biology of this body, and so he wasn't moved. Well, Kama was unhappy about that, and so he turned himself into Mara, M-A-R-A, the Lord of Death, to inspire fear. And he throws Buddha all the weaponry of an army of ogres. Nobody there. This is why we don't picture him in the early works. He was not present as a...
That's another thing I'm just going to mention. The Buddha, there was no images of the Buddha from 500 BCE until about the first century. Mm-hmm. And that the first century, so 500 years from Siddhartha's birth, then the images of the Buddha start showing up. Before that, there was no images, so he kind of mentions that.
Yeah, disengage yourself. And so the weapons were turned into lotuses as they entered his field of non-entity, and he was, as it were, worshipped. And now comes the hard one for good Christians to appreciate. Kama, Mara, was now desperate, and he turns himself into Dharma, the Lord of Social Duty. That's supposed to be Christianity. How in heaven's name you're going to find your own track if you're always doing what the society tells you your duty is, you see? So it's at that point that Mara, now as Dharma, duty, says to him, young prince, you are supposed to be on your throne, governing a country. Don't you read the morning papers? Don't you know what's going on? Things are falling apart. There are picket lines all over the place. What do you do when that call comes? He just dropped his hand and touched the earth. This is Bhumi Sparsha. Don't try to move me with this journalistic appeal. I'm interested in eternity. And he calls the goddess Mother Universe to witness to his right to be there. And she, in her majesty, with a voice that resounded like thunder around the horizon, said, this is my beloved son who, through innumerable lifetimes, has so given himself that there's nobody here. And with it?
So, we're running out of time, so there's one more thing he said.
You're sitting there, you're in the immovable spot, and no appeal of the journalistic field of time is going to move you. That's the first step. The second step is, having found the still point, come back into the field of time. So we have two Buddhisms. One, the small vehicle Buddhism that's gone.
So we talked about that too. Mm-hmm. The last quote I want to say for Andrew was, at the Buddha's death, the last thing that he was quoted as saying to his disciples was, be your own lamps. That everything you need for enlightenment is within yourself, and nobody else should tell you how to achieve enlightenment or nirvana. So that's his last quote right before he dies, be your own lamps. In Zen, there's a funnier quote that says, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Because nobody can be an authority to your own enlightenment except yourself. That is his final teaching. So, go in peace. Thank you.